Hello there. Today is Wednesday, January 24th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, new reports indicate the special counsel in the Russia investigation wants to interview the president.
Has the potential of being incredibly dangerous for this president.
The issue of immigration continues to be at the center of a battle that could again shut down the U.S. government. The message the president will bring to the World Economic Summit.
To tell the world that America is open for business.
Also ahead, the Oscar nominations have been announced. Who are the front runners? It's all on today's International Edition. U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions and the former director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, James Comey, have been interviewed by Special Counsel Robert Mueller's team as part of its investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election and whether there was collusion between Russia and President Donald Trump's election campaign. The New York Times reported Tuesday that Sessions was questioned for several hours last week about his contacts with Russian officials and whether Trump had obstructed justice, while Comey was interviewed last year in connection with a series of memos he wrote about his interactions with Trump. Sessions is the first member of the president's cabinet to be questioned by Mueller's office since the special counsel took over the Russia investigation last May after Trump fired the then FBI director Comey. Joining us now to discuss is former CIA agent and current criminal defense attorney Jack Rice. So, Jack, what do you make of these latest developments?
What I'm starting to see now is a shift in the investigation itself, because it seems to be two tracks. There's the one track that was sort of bigger than the president himself in terms of what the Russians were doing and how they were connected and working their way into the White House. But what you're seeing in the second track is you're seeing Bob Mueller specifically look at what was coming out of the Oval Office, or at least potentially the White House, and his closest advisors. And so the focus seems to be turning specifically on the president, what he said, and dare I say it, when he said it.
Does it also sort of indicate that this part of the investigation could be coming to an end?
I don't think so. I don't think this investigation is coming to an end. The one thing about Bob Mueller and the one thing about his team, they are thorough to a fault. They're going to turn over every single stone. And that may be well and good for those who oppose this president to come in and say, I want to see something happen now. That may be all well and good for those who are saying this is a witch hunt or supporting the president. The thing is what Bob Mueller's team is doing is creating an airtight investigation. And as a result of that, when they come back with answers, they're going to have backup to backup to backup to support those answers. And that's why I don't think this is over yet.
Does it seem like maybe it's turning to a new phase? Because we are also hearing, according to the Washington Post, it's reported that Mueller would like to now interview the president of the United States in the coming weeks. We also understand that his attorneys are trying to have this happen simply in writing. How dangerous is it for the president to get in there and talk? Can he do it in writing? Will that fly with Mueller? And does this seem to indicate that this is turning to a new phase in the investigation?
This is clearly a new phase in the investigation, because what you're seeing now is Bob Mueller and his team turning specifically to the president. What the president knew, who told him what, and who he told as a result. That means a lot for this president personally, potentially, and it could also mean a lot to those surrogates around the president as this investigation moves forward. So that is a fundamentally important shift. At the same time, has the potential of being incredibly dangerous for this president, because any time down with Mueller and his team, who are incredibly experienced at this, you better know exactly what you're saying. President Trump has said, I have nothing to hide. I did nothing wrong. I guess the response could be, well, if I didn't do anything wrong, then sit down with him. Of course, as a criminal attorney, I would say to simply sit down with this investigation, with this team, strikes me as dubious at best, because the potential is they're opening him up to something more. Remember, there are two different pieces of this investigation as it applies to this president. Number one is whether or not he was involved in the collusion by the Russians to manipulate this election, whether he encouraged it, whether he helped it, whether he turned a blind eye to it. That's one piece. The second piece is the obstruction piece, and that's the piece where the president knew about the investigation and tried to put roadblocks in front of it.
So you don't think that Mueller will be okay with just getting answers in writing, which obviously could be written by anybody?
No. As a former prosecutor, I wouldn't want my answers in writing. I'm not there to interview the president's attorneys. I'm not. I want to know what the president knows, and I want to know his responses. And I also want to look him in the eye when I'm cross-examining him. I want to know what he's doing. I want to see what makes him sweat. I want to see what makes him uncomfortable, what makes him mad. Those are all issues that matter when you're starting to do an investigation like this. And this is the big part, is that this team knows enormous amounts of material about what's been going on, what was said, by whom, to this president. Those are all things you can't do if you're doing everything in writing. The most important question is never the first, always the second.
If President Trump gives an answer regarding his former national security advisor, Michael Flynn, who has already been cooperating with the investigation, if he gives a different answer and is accused of perjuring himself, couldn't he just turn around and say, well, it's my word against his and he was fired for lying, meaning Flynn?
If Mike Flynn says the president's lying and the president says Mike Flynn is lying, is that enough for Bob Mueller to go forward and continue investigating and perhaps even trying to indict this president? The answer is yes, because then it becomes a question of fact. And the question of fact is something that a jury could potentially look at. It's something that prosecutors do all of the time. When you only have two people in a room and they're both saying the other guy did it, they frequently will charge one of those guys. They have to decide which one is the more credible. Because if you get Mike Flynn saying something with a whole bunch of documentation and support and saying the president said X, Y, and Z, and then the president comes in and lies about it, guess what? You can't lie to the Bureau during an active investigation. It is a crime. That's why his attorneys are so afraid of having him sit down with Bob Mueller, because of what the president could do to himself.
All right. Former CIA agent and current criminal defense attorney Jack Rice, thanks for your perspective. A partial U.S. government shutdown ended Monday, with Senate Democrats providing enough votes to restart federal funding for the next few weeks in return for a promise by the Republican leadership to bring an immigration bill up for a vote by February 8th. VOA House correspondent Catherine Gibson looks at how the brief shutdown sets up an even tougher fight ahead on Capitol Hill.
It was the briefest of shutdowns. Across Washington, some prominent sites and offices closed up on the first full workday after funding expired midnight Friday. But lawmakers stayed, working an intense weekend of negotiations that eventually yielded a breakthrough.
So long as the government remains open, it would be my intention to take up legislation here in the Senate that would address DACA, border security, and related issues, and it would be my strong preference for the Senate to consider a proposal that can actually be signed into law.
The fate of DACA recipients, the more than 800,000 undocumented young people brought to the U.S. as children, is at the heart of congressional Democrats' demands.
The Republican majority now has 17 days to prevent the Dreamers from being deported.
That February 8th deadline in the new spending bill sets the stage for even bigger partisan battles as both sides look back on what they learned from this shutdown.
We were pleased to see Senator Schumer accept the deal that President Trump put on the table from the very beginning. We will make a long-term deal on immigration if and only if it's good for our country.
But even members of the president's own party wondered what the White House meant by a good deal.
You know, the president is here one day and there the next. I think he's got a good heart about this. I think he knows what will work. Here's what I predict. Once we start talking about immigration and voting on immigration, we'll find 60 votes to make sure these DACA recipients' lives are not ruined.
And Democrats in the House of Representatives doubt those assurances. Congressman Luis Gutierrez, a vocal supporter of Dreamers, said his party gave in too early. Other House Democrats wondered if the Senate leader's promise will be kept on their side of Capitol Hill.
We're asking for Paul Ryan to make the commitment to deal with our broken immigration system, which he has failed to do.
Any deal negotiated in the Senate will face a much tougher road to passage in the House, where the numbers favor Republicans, setting the stage for yet another government shutdown. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Capitol Hill.
Well, the World Economic Forum officially gets underway Tuesday in Davos, Switzerland. President Trump departs today and arrives on Thursday. I'll give a speech on Friday. Trump plans to meet with world leaders and dine with business executives during the trip. Top Trump economic advisor Gary Cohn said the president's going to Davos to tell the world that America is open for business.
The president is going to Davos to speak to world leaders about investing in the United States, moving businesses to the United States, hiring American workers, changing the direction of our economy to be one of the biggest and best and most efficient economies in the world.
National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster attended Tuesday's White House briefing, noting that the president will also use his time in Davos to discuss national security,
including the international effort to denuclearize the Korean Peninsula, our coalition to defeat ISIS, our efforts to counter Iran's destructive agenda to perpetuate violence across the greater Middle East, as well as Iran's ballistic missile activity and the fundamental flaws in the Iran nuclear deal.
Hundreds of protesters have been marching in Switzerland's largest city, Zurich, to denounce the forum and the planned visit of President Trump. The protest is the latest and potentially most combative among a few anti-Trump protests since the White House announced his attendance. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Police have arrested an armed man, near the White House. Russian-linked Twitter accounts not done with U.S. government shutdown. French President Emmanuel Macron's upcoming visit to Washington will be an official state visit. And U.S. health officials are urging flu vaccinations as pediatric deaths continue to rise. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Scientists are reporting progress on a blood test to detect many types of cancer at an early stage, including some of the most deadly that lack screening tools for now. The results of a groundbreaking study by Johns Hopkins University scientists looked at how well their experimental tests detected cancer in people already known to have the disease. The blood tests found about 70% of 8 common types of cancer in more than 1,000 patients. In many cases, the test narrowed the possible origin of the cancer to 1 or 2 places, such as the colon or lung. Well, joining us now is one of the study's researchers, Dr. Nicholas Papadopoulos of Johns Hopkins. First, doctor, tell us what cancers the test was able to detect.
We detected 8 cancers. 3 of them are very common: colorectal cancer, lung cancer, breast cancer. Then the other 5, not that they are really common, they are less common, but still big killers. But the distinction there is that we don't have any screening modalities, and those are pancreatic cancer, ovarian cancer, esophageal, stomach cancer, liver cancer. So those are the 8 ones that we detected. Now, I want to say that was in the study. We had those 1,000-plus individuals that they had these cancers. That does not mean that this test cannot detect other cancer types, but we can't report on that since we didn't test it yet.
Okay. I would think that would be especially critical for the ones, like you said, that there are no other early detection, like pancreatic, which can be very deadly by the time it's caught.
That's right. That's part of the attraction of this thing, yes.
I understand it also can detect the location of the cancer. How would that work?
That's, I think, one of the novel part of our test. So I'll take a step back because it's kind of tied together. We use 2 analytes. We use DNA, specifically pieces of 16 genes, and we look for mutations that exist in cancer cells. But also we use another analyte, which has been used in the past, biomarkers. So the combination of the two not only helps us to increase sensitivity, but actually it's the combination of all this information plus some algorithms that one of our co-authors, Dr. Tomasetti, has developed that actually allows us to narrow down the location down to 2 sites. And that is important. It's unique for the study, but it's also important because if we think what the ultimate use of this test is to screen people that are non-symptomatic for early detection of early cancers. These people, when they take the test, they're going to look healthy, they're going to appear healthy, and we won't know where the cancer was. So they're going to get a positive result, and it will be very helpful for the physician to at least give some information to the physician to where this cancer, this potential cancer could be. So that's, we think, actually, that it's one of the innovative part of our study.
How big of a breakthrough is this for saving lives? Is it a game changer, ultimately?
Well, ultimately, yeah. I mean, obviously, we need to start the next phase, which is validate this test in individuals that they don't have cancer. But ultimately, early detection of cancer overall, we think, is a game changer because we know, I mean, there are enough data to suggest or indicate, actually, not only just suggest, that when the cancers, any type almost, when we catch them early, the patient has greater chance of survival, not just prolongation of life by a few months or a few years, but survival. So that, having a test, a single test to detect a lot of different tumor types at early stages, we think that this will be a game changer because we feel that it's going to ultimately save a lot of lives. Early detection of cancer overall, from our work and from other people's work, we have to start changing our thinking to how to attack cancer overall. Right now, the most common thing is somebody comes down with some symptoms, it goes to the doctor, and a lot of times it's a late-stage cancer that because the person had symptoms. That's why usually we have symptoms, because it's a late-stage cancer. And we treat these people. And as I said, although there's a lot of progress in developing new therapeutics, still we measure success by increasing the lifespan by months, sometimes by years, but not necessarily curing people. And I think that that's what, you know, if we switch as a scientist, as a society, start thinking that we need to first focus on screening and then on treating cancers, I think that will be the game changer.
I often think to myself, going to the doctor, you know, could this just, wouldn't it be great if as a standard part of your annual exam, you could, with all the other blood work you get to check all the other things, you know, your liver, your kidneys, couldn't we just find it, you know, couldn't they just take a blood test to say, hey, you might have cancer? My question would be, is that something that could be a possibility as a regular part of a routine annual exam at some point in time if this thing continues to prove that it is successful?
Yeah. Frankly, this is our vision here collectively. If you ever come to one of my lectures, you will see I have a slide in the end exactly like that, making that part of our physical. Now, is it going to be every year, every 3 years? I don't know, but that is really ultimately exactly what you said. That's where we need to go. We feel that we need to be there for the reasons that I explained earlier.
All right, Johns Hopkins Doctor of Oncology Nicholas Papadopoulos, thank you so much for being with us. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. VOA. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5 minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences announced its nominees for this year's Academy Awards Tuesday in Hollywood. As VOA's David Byrd reports, the Cold War fantasy romance The Shape of Water gathered the most nominations.
We're created in the Lord's image. You don't think that's what the Lord looks like, do you?
This creature is intelligent, capable of language, of understanding emotions.
Mexican-born director Guillermo del Toro's fantasy about a mute office cleaner who falls in love with an amphibious creature gathered 13 nominations, including Best Picture, Best Director for Del Toro, Best Actress for Sally Hawkins, and nominations in the Best Supporting Actor and Best Supporting Actress categories. Film critic Tim Robey says that The Shape of Water has to be considered the front runner for Best Picture.
But it's not way ahead of the pack, and I think there could be a surprise on the night, and it could be a surprise along the lines of Get Out, for instance. Very popular film, one of the real audience successes of the year, and a film with very timely themes as well. That could really sneak up there, I think.
Christopher Nolan's World War II drama Dunkirk was second with 8 nominations, including Best Director for Nolan and several technical awards.
My daughter Angela was murdered 7 months ago. It seems to me the police department is too busy torturing black folks to solve actual crime.
What the hell is this?
The crime dramedy Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri got 7 nominations, including Best Picture, Best Actress for Golden Globe winner Frances McDormand, and Best Supporting Actor for both Woody Harrelson and Sam Rockwell.
We must negotiate peace talks.
When will the lesson be learned? You cannot reason with a tiger when your head is in its mouth!
British veteran and Golden Globe winner Gary Oldman received a Best Acting nod for his portrayal of Winston Churchill in Darkest Hour. Others in the category included Daniel Day-Lewis for Phantom Thread, Daniel Kaluuya for Get Out, and Denzel Washington for Roman J. Israel, Esquire.
You should just go to City College. You know, with your work ethic, just go to City College and then to jail and then back to City College, and then maybe you'd learn to pull yourself up and not expect everybody to do everything.
Saoirse Ronan earned a Best Actress nomination for her role in Lady Bird. The film's director, Greta Gerwig, also received a Best Directing nomination. Laurie Metcalf was nominated in the Best Supporting Actress category. The awards are the first Oscar nominations since the sexual assault and harassment scandal surrounding former producer Harvey Weinstein broke. Weinstein has denied any wrongdoing, but film critic Tim Robey says these nominations show there is some recognition of the need for change.
People were worried that they would miss off Greta Gerwig. She didn't get nominated for the Golden Globe, so that was an all-male directing field. But this time they've kind of rectified that. People were worried that they wouldn't nominate Daniel Kaluuya, but they have. And 2 black women for supporting actress. It's kind of looking a bit better than usual, I would say. The little baby steps perhaps being made towards rectifying it.
The Oscars will be handed out March 4th. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
Thanks, David. And now turning to what's trending on social media, Doug Bernard joins us. Doug, we've been talking about the Oscars, and apparently so have people on social media.
More than people like talking about who got nominated, people really like talking about who didn't get nominated. In other words, who got snubbed. And one of the biggest trenders that we've seen on social media today, Facebook, Twitter, and whatnot, is Oscar snubs or some variant of that, hashtag Oscar snub. I have a whole bunch of comments here. I'm just going to go through some of them. So, big surprises. Phantom Thread shows up in Best Pick, the year's most awarded docs. Jane and the City of Ghosts snubbed. James Franco gets the boot. Of course, James Franco recently coming under fire under allegations of some sexual misconduct. He's snubbing James Franco, says Ira Madison. Ramin Sotoudeh says they snubbed Armie Hammer for Call Me By Your Name. A lot of people saying that Armie Hammer had the supporting actor role, although it really was a two-actor movie, but he got nothing despite picking up nods from the Screen Actors Guild and some others as well. Yeah, I love that Netflix finally broke through in the Oscars. Please remember this, don't undervaluate a black woman. T.J. Holmes is not at all happy that Wonder Woman didn't get a nod. Erica Cruz is not at all happy that Good Time and Robert Pattinson were snubbed, but we already knew that was going to happen again, didn't we? Amy Adams was ignored despite a brilliant performance in Arrival. Now it's the turn of Jessica Chastain to be snubbed for Molly's Game. What is this, an anti-ginger conspiracy? Well, I for one hope not. Legit shock snubs Holly Hunter, Lego Movie, the Lego Batman movie. the Post screenplay and Tom Hanks. Post didn't pick up hardly anything. Nothing for Tom Hanks, nothing for screenplay, not for Best Picture, and not for Best Director. So not a lot of love given there. So that's just a sampling of what people are talking about. Here's my analysis, the last one, Kyle Buchanan. Phantom Thread really benefited from being the last film so many voters watched. So anyway, this is going to be a topic of conversations, no doubt, on social media for some time to come until the actual awards ceremony.
All right. Thank you so much, Doug. You can follow him on Twitter at DFrontiers. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. South African jazz legend Hugh Masekela died on Tuesday at the age of 78, his family announced, triggering an outpouring of tributes to his music, his long career, and his anti-apartheid activism. Among his greatest hits were the beloved anthem Bring Him Back Home, demanding Nelson Mandela's freedom from jail. Masekela's family said in a statement that he died peacefully at home in Johannesburg after a courageous battle with prostate cancer. He fled apartheid South Africa in 1960 and didn't return until after the release of Mandela in 1990. Keeping up his international touring schedule into the 70s, his concerts at home often became mass sing-alongs. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Dave Magnus. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
President Donald Trump recently welcomed Kazakh President Nursultan Nazarbayev to the White House, where he noted that Kazakhstan has made great strides since gaining independence in 1991. In the years since Kazakhstan's independence, the United States and Kazakhstan worked together to rid Kazakhstan of nuclear weapons and secure dangerous radiological materials. Kazakhstan continues to be a valued partner in nuclear nonproliferation. Presidents Trump and Nazarbayev discussed efforts to achieve a Korean peninsula free of nuclear weapons. Together, said President Trump, we are determined to prevent the North Korean regime from threatening the world with nuclear devastation. President Trump also thanked President Nazarbayev for his assurances that Kazakhstan will continue to provide critical access for supplies and equipment used by U.S. troops fighting ISIS and the Taliban in Afghanistan. The U.S. particularly appreciates Kazakhstan's work to train and educate Afghan civilian specialists and Kazakhstan's pledge of additional support to bolster Afghan security. American businesses are currently among the largest investors in Kazakhstan, particularly in the energy sector. The U.S. supports Kazakhstan's efforts to become a top 30 global economy by 2050. That includes working to improve Kazakhstan's business environment, which will create new opportunities for American companies operating there and provide additional jobs in both countries. President Trump stressed the importance of fair and reciprocal trade for both countries. The United States values Kazakhstan's participation in the Central Asia Trade Forum and in the Central Asia Trade and Investment Framework Agreement. Both countries are working together to bring U.S. products and services to the Kazakhstani people across a range of industries, including commercial aircraft, railways, medical services, technology, and energy. Working in common cause, we can advance greater opportunity for citizens in both of our countries, said President Trump. We want a strong, sovereign, and thriving future for Kazakhstan and for the peace-loving nations of the world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.